So you can take a look at the properties you own or properties you're looking to buy and see, hey, does this actually make sense to do a cost segregation study? Am I actually going to save money? Is it going to be worthwhile? And I think for most people, it's a no-brainer, meaning either the numbers make sense and it's like, yeah, okay, I'm going to spend $3,000 and save $50.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. It's your friends, Tate and Ryan. How you doing, man?
Doing great. Been a great summer. And I did something really cool. I climbed Mount Baker. I ran the Ragnar race with my Spartan team. And I just hiked a 21-mile through hike in the Enchantments. And I did it all in 5 days. So I did 55 miles and about 15,000 feet of vertical. I was proud
of myself.
That's
incredible.
Pat on the back.
That's amazing. Yeah. I only was back from Europe for about a week, and then I got called by my company to see if I wanted to ferry an A321 to the Philippines for the first aircraft's heavy check, which was kind of cool. So I got to go to Guam. Never been there before. Did an 18-hour layover in Guam and then over to the Philippines with an empty airplane with a couple of mechanics on board. That was pretty fun. That's my latest.
Never a dull day in Tate's life. My most recent flying story was I ran a 182 Skylane out of Everett Payne Field and flew my kids up to Orcas Island. We did our annual airplane camping trip where you actually take the kids and you camp under the wing, a lot of cool warbirds flying around, biplanes, stuff like that right off the runway. And then what's cool about Orcas Island, they give you free bikes, free courtesy car, and you can go into town and hang out and do the shops, and the kids just absolutely love the time with dad. So anyway.
That's so cool.
What are you working on? You've
got to do some more GA flying.
Yeah.
Well, we're launching a deal. We actually, by the time this episode is live, it will probably be launched. This is going to sound funny, but we're doing a Spartan deal at Turbine Capital. And the reason we do this is because we are a capital partner. We work with about 6 or 7 different operators from this at this point. We've done 4 deals in the past with Spartan. It's kind of funny now that we're running a podcast together and we would both sort of have the same offering open. But anyway, let me explain a little bit about that. So what we do is we aggregate capital from investors. We are a capital partner to syndicators and operating partners like Ryan. We are ambassadors to our investor group, where we do a ton of due diligence on the operator themselves and these particular deal before it ends up on our platform. And then by aggregating a large pool of capital, we're able to go and buy Spartan's best share class and actually offer our investors the same or better returns than they'd be going direct to sponsor. So sorry, Ryan, but I think if you want to invest in the growth fund, Spartan's growth fund, and you haven't done it already, we have that offering open on our platform. And because we're buying that highest and best share class, we get better economics where we take more of the profit split than Spartan does if you were going to go direct.
Collaboration.
So anyway, we have that open. I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, collaboration beats competition every day of the week. And we are absolutely collaborating here and partnering. So really honored, privileged to have Turbine Capital partner. So no love lost there at all. Really excited. And that fund has some really amazing deals in it. We're actually, we just put 2 properties under contract here in Washington State, where we're building new developments here. So we're pretty excited about that. In addition to the 3 other properties already slated to close and start and break ground in the growth fund. So really great timing on that deal. Go ahead, Tate.
Well, we're excited to launch that. You know, we did a ton of due diligence, even though we've done deals with Spartan in the past, very comfortable with them as an operator. We know a ton about their track record. We dug really deep into site selection and their criteria, as well as the underwriting on the deals that have already been placed. Did a ton of work with our senior advisor, Mike Rhodes, who's been in the storage industry for 30 years and has done all sorts of development. We had a couple of deep dive conversations offline with Ryan and the team. So we went very deep on this, very excited about it. So But anyway, Ryan, you were going to say.
No, I was going to say, and I'm really excited too. If anybody has a 1031 exchange, so if you're selling real property and you want to invest that into an institutional quality self-storage syndication, we actually have a deal open. So for anybody out here that's like, man, I'm selling all my rental properties, I don't want to pay the taxes, I want to go into something that you guys are doing and be completely passive, we have a DST fund that allows 1031 exchange investors to come in. So if you have more details on that, unfortunately with that deal, we can't partner with Turbine because we can't offer different share classes. You're actually going to be on the real estate. So it's a little bit of a different structuring. So we're working on that now. If you have any questions about that, feel free to get in touch with myself. And with that, I'm going to transition to our guest today, Yona Weiss.
Yeah, who, we just had an incredible conversation with Yona. Sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, Yona Weiss, who I've actually personally hired Yona to do, I don't know, 25, 30 cost segregation studies. So, you know, we only bring guests onto the show that A, are going to be applicable to our listeners, and B, who we would trust and use ourselves. And so Yona Weiss has done a great job, tremendous job for us doing our cost segregation studies, going to our properties, his company, Madison Specs, and doing the cost segregation and benefiting our investors by saving them millions of dollars, literally in taxes, over the past, I don't know, 5-10 years that we've been doing cost segregation studies. So a lot of action-packed stuff. Tate, you want to give us a little background on Yona, kind of who he is, where he comes from? Who is this guy?
Yeah, Yona is, he's talk about a personal branding expert. You know, he has had just branded himself as the cost segregation expert, and he really is. So he's a powerhouse with property owners' tax savings. He's a business director at Madison Specs, which is a national cost segregation leader. They do cost segregation studies in all 50 states, and he's assisted clients in saving hundreds of millions of dollars through cost segregation. He's also has a background in teaching, which you'll hear about, passion for real estate investing and helping others. And he also is the host of the Weiss Advice podcast. So if you want to learn more about cost segregations and tax savings around that, after this episode, you can certainly go check that out. He's also active on Twitter, which we talk about. Really a great educator in the space. So excited for this conversation.
Well, let's get right into it.
Yona Weiss, thank you so much for coming on the show. We're so happy to have you.
I'm excited to be here equally.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, Yona, great to see you. And it's good. You probably have done, I think, like 20 cost segregation studies for us, maybe 30. I don't know. It's been a lot. So pretty much everything.
How many cost segregations have you done in the history of your career?
Of me personally or the company?
The company.
Your company. We've done a little over, I haven't counted this year to date yet, but a little over 25,000.
25,000. So you know what you're doing.
We've done a few, yeah.
So Yona, I want to just before we get into your background and sort of how you became this cost segregation expert, can you just start from square one and help the audience understand what a cost segregation study is? And that'll kind of tie us into who you are, your background, and why you wanted to become this expert on cost segs.
Sure. So, I mean, cost segregation, it's a weird name, right? But all it is a tax deduction. That's it. It's a very advanced form of depreciation, which is a tax deduction that you get when you buy a property. And besides for your primary residence, any rental or business property, you're able to literally write off the entire value of that property minus the land. But you can't do it all at once. So what depreciation says, it's a weird, also, it's a misnomer. And everything with the tax code, I think on purpose, they're trying to confuse you. They're like, oh yeah, segregation. People are not going to pay attention to this. Well, let's just make sure, give it a weird name so people are going to, stay away from it. And depreciation is like, oh yeah, that's a negative thing. I don't want anything to do with depreciation. But really, it's just a borrowed term. And what it means is that you're able to take a write-off as if your property is going down in value, when in fact, it's probably going up in value. And you're able to literally take a tax deduction based on the theory, right, that it is going down in value, or that would be going down in value. So it's over a 27.5-year period of time for residential and multifamily properties, and for commercial properties over a 39-year period. So just think of it like this. You have this pool of potential deductions that you can take, right? You buy a property for $1 million. You can minus land. You can take, $30,000 a year for the next 39 years, right? However, cost segregation allows you to break down or segregate the cost into different components, into different parts of the property that actually some things depreciate faster, which allows you to take from that pool of potential deductions and take those, you know, deductions in the earlier years of ownership.
Hey, Yona, right. What would you say to a CPA that says that this sounds aggressive, that you're going to get audited, that this is, you know, this is going to be something that's going to trip an audit and you're going to get screwed? What would you say to that?
Well, I don't know. I would say to that CPA anything, but but I would say to the client, find a new CPA. That's what I would say. You know, I tweeted something out a few weeks ago. Like, I just got off the call. This is a true story. I got off the call with a client reviewing the cost segregation study we're doing together. I just like to review it sometimes with people to understand the numbers. And they said they spoke to their CPA, and the CPA thinks it's some kind of scam, right? And then I, like, you know, tweeted, in other news, my client's looking for a new CPA, you know. but the point is this is directly from the tax code. Okay. Cost segregation is not some weird scam, not some weird rules. It's not whether it will be compliant or not. And it does not trigger an audit because it's actually considered by the IRS the correct or proper way to depreciate your property, to break things out into their respective, you know, lifespans.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Toby Mathis said on episodes 10 and 14. We'd have to obviously tee those up. If you haven't gone back and listened to episodes 10 and 14 with Toby Mathis, we talked a lot about this, but I'm excited today to really deep dive into this. So sorry, Ryan, you were talking about cost segging on all of your properties.
No, I've cost segged every property I've ever owned, and I've never been audited. Yep. Knock on some serious wood here, but I haven't been audited. And so it doesn't automatically trip an audit, and I'm walking proof of that. So, How long has this been around? So it's cost segregation. This isn't something that's like brand new, right? It's not something that came out yesterday or a shiny new object. How long has it been here?
Yeah, it's been around for a long time. Really, it in its current form, it's changed. You know, it's taken on, you know, new rules over the years. But originally in its form, in the 80s, when there was a big tax reform of the Reagan administration, that's when cost segregation came about. And again, like I said, it's developed over time, essentially with different court cases and different rulings that have included different assets to be considered cost segregatable, if you will. But essentially what that means is that what we're doing is breaking out the structural components of the property that depreciate at that long period of time, 27, 39 years, from the what's considered personal property that can be depreciated on a five-year schedule. And so there's been all kinds of cases over the years saying, well, flooring, you know, needs to be replaced every 5 years or something. So therefore, it shouldn't be included in the structure. It should be the value of that should be included in the five-year property, allowing you to take those deductions at a faster rate, et cetera. And there, again, have been more and more things added on to actually make it more beneficial until most recent years. The biggest change that came about was back in 2017 with the introduction of 100% bonus depreciation, which was a huge game changer for the entire, you know, commercial real estate and cost segregation industry.
Yeah, well, I want to deep dive.
Yeah,
sorry.
Say, before we get into
just giving a little teaser,
I like it.
Teaser. We're going to stick on cost seg for just another minute here. I know the bonus is like the coolest thing ever, but and for those listeners, we're going to put in the show notes. I've got actually had a case study that I dove deep into with Yona. I don't know if Yona, if you remember this.
Five or six years ago.
Yeah. Right. On a webinar with my CPA. Actually, I had my CPA on. I had Yona on. And we dove into a real property. We'll get that in the show notes. So if you actually want to go through like all the numbers and stuff and totally nerd out, we have that that show that we'll put in the show notes for you. I wanted to get to cost segregation because obviously you have this straight line depreciation, residential 27 and a half years, commercial properties 39 years. Can you kind of first speak to that and then maybe kind of bucket out how the other short-term life is broken out?
Sure. Every accountant knows that your property, as I mentioned before, you get this depreciation deduction. And simply what they're going to do is take the purchase price, allocate a certain amount for land, which, you know, that's a whole subject in itself, how you get the land value. But, you know, typically it's around, you know, 15 to 20% can be more or less. And you just parenthetically, I remember a property we did for you, like an RV park in the middle of nowhere in Texas. And the land value was like less than 1% or something like that.
It was like $800. $800. Yeah. Because like that's what the county assessor's site said. So it was, it was you know, in writing. So.
Right. As opposed to some places in California where it can be like 60 or 70% land value. So that's the first thing you do. And every accountant knows that you take what's called straight line depreciation and you essentially just divide that value over a 27 and a half year period and take a little bit of a deduction every single year. So simple math, take a $1 million property, take off 15% for land, you're left with $850,000. Divide that by 27.5. It's about $30,000 a year. Okay. I'm not a genius. I've done this before. So I'm just repeating myself, right? $30,000 a year tax deduction is great. And most people, especially if you have single families or residential properties, you're able to, in many cases, use that deduction to offset or reduce any taxable income that you would have from that property. And so depreciation in of itself, after other deductions, you know, mortgage, insurance, et cetera, you can essentially be, you know, and this is why they talk about tax deductions as being one of the biggest components of real estate investing, is that even with single families, you can just with the normal, regular, straight line depreciation, in most cases, you're able to write off, you know, all of that taxable income from your properties.
That's amazing. So let's get into the segregation part. So you obviously, everybody should be doing straight line. And I think if you actually don't do straight line, you get treated like you had straight line when you sell the property anyway. So if you're not doing straight line depreciation, I would have a definitely firing conversation with your CPA. Mm-hmm. We're not giving advice here, but we are being friendly.
Yeah, but you know, people do their own taxes sometimes. They just, you may not know any better that they have to check off or claim, you know, write, you know, on that depreciation part.
Yeah, you're getting that depreciation no matter what. So you've got to take it. So let's go into the segregation parts of it. You know, using maybe a single family home as an example.
Sure. So it's very detailed engineering study of the property. And so this is why it's so important to have a cost segregation company that focuses on this, because the IRS requires someone with construction or engineering background to be able to break out the property into its different components. And cost segregation used to be called component depreciation, which makes a lot more sense, right?
It does make a lot more sense.
Right? We're like, okay, we have the walls and the roof and the doors and the windows and the foundation, all of that's structural. Okay, so we're going to identify, you know, how much of that is, you know, if it's like, you know, 25,000 square feet or whatever. Okay, we're dealing with single family, so it's not going to be that big, right? 2,500 square feet, let's say. And, you know, the roof is X value, okay, based on the construction cost, et cetera. And then we're going to go down and break down literally into the tiny minute detail, to the nails, the paint, everything. So then we'll break out things that are non-structural. And there's essentially two other categories besides for the structure. Okay. So again, we mentioned a few times structure, 27.5 year schedule. And that's always going to be the majority of the value of any property, is in most properties are going to be in the structure. Because, you know, if you were to reverse engineer the property and rebuild it, it would cost much more to build, you know, the walls and foundation and roof, et cetera, besides for the things that are non-structural. And so what those two other categories are is, number one, land improvements. Okay. So this depreciates on a 15-year schedule. And that includes anything outside of the property. And so land doesn't depreciate, but anything that's on top of the land does. And you may think that's insignificant, but when you look at a property, even a single family, you have a sidewalk, you may have some landscaping, fencing, stormwater drainage. If you have a swimming pool, you know, that's huge. It's concrete. All of that has value and can be significant value. That now we can identify what the value of those components are, take the depreciation over that 15-year schedule. So we're accelerating the depreciation deductions, again, pulling from that pool of potential and then just front loading that. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say some other great examples of like land improvements that can be substantial are things like golf courses, RV parks, mobile home parks, where there's a lot of utility infrastructure that's going into land improvement bucket. But
you're absolutely right. And that's one thing that gets overlooked a lot, because, you know, people think, oh, I have a mobile home park, an RV park, like what's there? It's just land, right? Land doesn't depreciate. And then you're like, oh, but what's on top of the land does. So the concrete pads, you know, under each home, it's huge. And so actually mobile home parks, RV parks can be one, as you know, can be one of the greatest asset classes for cost segregation, because there's very little structure.
So we're doing this a little bit backwards, but I think this is a perfect opportunity to talk about your background, because, you know, we were talking a little bit before the show and how, you know, a lot of airline pilots, myself and maybe even Ryan included, became accidental investors in the beginning, mm-hmm. where, you know, we started buying up rental properties and started getting a little bit more sophisticated. So walk us through your journey. Let's go back to the beginning of the show where we say, okay, tell us about your background. Where are you from? How'd you get into real estate? How did you learn about cost segregation in the first place? Sort of walk us through that journey.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, in that light, I'm probably an accidental conservation expert, you know, like,
yeah.
I didn't start out, you know, thinking, oh, when I grow up, I want to be a conservation expert. But I was a teacher for many years. So about 15 years, I spent time and, you know, I ran a nonprofit organization for needy families and widows, orphans and things like that. People had, you know, tragedies. And so my, you know, day to day was involved with that. Well, many, you know, doing that for about 15 years, I didn't really have any background in business or finance or investing or anything like that. And so I ended up, you know, growing a large amount of student debt and then, you know, more debt piled on top of that with a growing family. It was just becoming almost unbearable to really keep up and keep our heads afloat. At that point, we had a little bit of a, you know, crisis in our family that really just kind of put a light bulb on in my head, like, okay, I need to make some changes. I need to figure out what, you know, get my act together here and figure out what I can do. And so I reached out to some friends and real estate kept coming up in conversation with friends and acquaintances. Like, oh, you want to do something new? You want to do something different, a side hustle, whatever it is. Real estate, why don't you, you know, get involved in real estate somehow or another? And there were a lot of different options. People had different ideas for me. And then I ended up meeting a friend in the street one day in the parking lot, actually. And he said, I knew he was in real estate somehow, but I never really talked to him about it because I wasn't really interested. I was like, hey, I'm looking for an opportunity. What do you think? He's like, you know what? I was a mortgage broker for many years and I just left this company. I'm going off my own. You should come join me and I'll just teach you, you know, everything I know about commercial real estate. I was like, okay, great. Turns out he not only was a successful mortgage broker, but he was also, you know, hard money lender. And he also owned his family owned properties and he was doing property management, asset management, you know, remotely, all kinds of stuff. So I sat in his office for about 6-8 months or so, almost every day. And I just learned from him and we, you know, closed some deals, we sourced deals, cold call, all the good stuff that had to do with commercial real estate, you know, to the point I had no idea. I didn't know what all, you know, cap rates and LTVs and all this stuff. I knew nothing. He was like, I was a mortgage broker. I remember our first conversation. He's like, I'm a mortgage broker. I'm like, what does that mean? You know, like, right. What's a mortgage broker? You know, what's a mortgage, right? But little by little I learned. And I think because of my teaching background, I was able to really use that to my advantage to learn things very quickly and be able to give them over and teach. So fast forward a few years doing that, and I did some fix and flips. I ended up getting my residential broker's license, also just getting involved in real estate, learning different things until I was introduced to this company, Madison Commercial Real Estate, Madison Specs, and they were hiring, and I was interested in a new opportunity in business development. It just worked out, had a conversation. Sounded great on paper. And I was like, okay, good people. And in fact, I had reached out to one of my mentors at the time, a person I'd known who's a very successful industrial real estate developer. He's developed over 15 million square feet of, owned and developed for himself. So I was like, hey, you know, you heard of this thing called cost segregation? And he's like, oh yeah, sure. Cost segregation. I'm like, you heard of this company, Madison Specs? He's like, yeah, sure. We use them for all of our cost saves. I'm like, okay, great. So he's like, yeah, go for it. They're good people, good company. And that's kind of the rest is history.
I love it. I love it. That's amazing. So when you started doing cost segregation studies and when you started learning about them, did you apply that to any of your did you own personal properties at that point, single family homes, single family rentals? And did you do some cost segs on those, and how did those go?
I didn't actually, because at that point I had done only fix and flips. And so I never had any actually rental properties.
Right.
Which is important to note. A lot of people think, oh, can I do a cost seg on a fix and flip? And so the answer is no. It needs to be a rental property that you're holding. And that's only then can you take a depreciation deduction.
Understood. What does it look like if someone owns, let's say, you know, a couple of properties and they're just finding out about this and they say, this sounds interesting. I think I should explore this. What is it? Because we look at cost segregation studies on syndication deals, large self-storage facilities, mobile home parks, all day long, but it's a little bit more rare to talk about. Let's start cost segging personal rental properties, right? So how much do these things cost? What does the process look like? And what are the pros and cons of doing them?
It certainly can be done on any property. And yes, there is a cost involved. So there's always going to be that question of, does the benefit outweigh the cost? You know, and traditionally people think it costs, you know, $20,000, $30,000 to get a cost segregation study done. And when that's not true at all, you know, it costs maybe $3,000, $4,000 nowadays. It used to be like that. And so I think there's like this Journal of Accountancy article. Like if you Google cost segregation, you'll inevitably come across this Journal of Accountancy article from like 2003. And it says this is, you know, cost prohibitive for any properties, you know, because it costs like $30,000 on average to get. So people Google, I've actually seen people like copy and paste that article into like a blog post about cost segregation. You know, it happened twice that people like tagged me on social media on like this blog article. And it was literally like a copy and paste of this article. And I could tell because I knew the article. I was like, this is not only it's plagiarism, but it's also outdated and wrong.
Right.
So yeah, it costs about $2,000-$3,000, you know, maybe a little more depending on the size and type of property. Commercial properties are a little bit more still. But the way to know if it's going to be worthwhile or not is we always like to run a free upfront feasibility analysis so you can see what the potential tax savings are. And typically it's about, I recommend it on properties purchased for over, you know, $200,000-$300,000. It's going to start to make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Obviously the...
I love that. I just want to highlight, this is like a huge benefit that you do that free analysis because like you don't want to know if you're going to spend the $3,000-$4,000 for the whole study. That is basically going to tell you what you're going to save in taxes. And that's huge. And we did that at Spartan. So we use Madison Specs to do our cost segregation studies. We would do that preliminary study. And so even we were raising money for a syndication. So if you're listening to this and you're like, oh, I'm thinking about raising money to, you know, buy a multifamily building or whatever, you can get this preliminary study done so you can kind of tell your investors what they can expect to save in taxes from the cost segregation. So sorry, I just didn't want that to go unnoticed. That's a huge benefit that you guys do that. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And most companies will do it like that. And the important thing to note is you asked, you know, Tate about the pros and the cons. I think one of the biggest cons that comes along with cost segregation is that there are rules as who can actually benefit from these deductions. So yes, we talked about getting these deductions and I didn't really go too much detail into how much it's actually gonna save you, but like on $1 million property, you know, just kind of going back to our example, and you're getting that $30,000 deduction every single year. Well, with cost segregation, you can literally pull something as 20 or 30% of those deductions, potential deductions, you know, into the first year, the first few years. So instead of like, you know, $30,000 a year, in the first 5 years, you can cumulatively get, you know, $200,000-$300,000. And so that's significant. You know, that's huge.
So we're talking about bonus depreciation here, right? So
also bonus depreciation, but even not with bonus depreciation, cumulatively over the first five years, you're going to be getting a large amount.
Right. Well, let's deep dive on this. Let's deep dive into non-bonus because bonuses, unless it gets reenacted, it's going to be gone in 5 years. Let's talk about the non-bonus and sort of how that works. And then we'll sort of sprinkle the gasoline on the fire with bonus depreciation.
Sure. So as we were mentioning, as we were talking about before, the different assets, breaking out the components. So we had the land improvements and we talked about, you know, mobile home parks and all that stuff, landscaping. And then the other main category is what's called five-year property or personal or tangible property. And this can include things that you wouldn't think necessarily are going to be, you know, personal or tangible or movable property, but the IRS considers it as such because it has, you know, they call it a useful life, right, over the five-year period. And this can include stuff like furniture, fixtures, right, appliances, you know, those are things that are movable, but even stuff like light fixtures, window treatments, cabinets, countertops, millwork, or, you know, many types of, you know, electrical and plumbing and things like that. So there's a lot that goes in the property that you wouldn't even imagine. And again, each property is going to be different from residential to commercial. You talk about self-storage, right? Mm-hmm. There's different things like the climate control and the storage facilities are huge, you know, carpeting, flooring. As long as it's, as we mentioned before, if it's glued to the floor, it's considered structural. But if it's floating wood or it's vinyl, PVC, or carpeting, all of that's considered five-year property. So the engineers are going to come in, identify the value of that. And again, this can be sometimes 20 or 30% of the total property value in that five-year property, which means you can take those deductions over the first 5 years. So that's non-bonus. That's just called regular cost segregation, where we're segregating out these costs into these different faster depreciation categories, allowing you to take those deductions in the earlier years.
Love it. Okay. So now, should we talk about the bonus depreciation? This is the most exciting thing.
Let's switch gears and talk bonus. Let's do it.
Let's do bonus.
Let's do it.
So there was a tax reform a few years ago, 2018, really the end of 2017, and it introduced this new law called 100% bonus depreciation. Now, bonus depreciation has been around in many forms for a couple decades, but this was the first time that it was introduced that allowed you to take 100% all of those accelerated deductions in the 5 and 15 year categories all up front in the first year. Okay, and not just for new construction, which is what the law used to apply to, just for new construction properties. Now it applied to any property that you purchased, whether new construction or not. And the important thing to note, a lot of people get confused about this, depreciation and cost segregation starts over every time the property changes hands, which means it's not intrinsic. It's like, oh, I bought this building, but it was built in 1972. So, you know, 27 and a half years already passed. No. Your depreciation schedule of 27 and a half years starts the day you buy the property or the day you place it in service. And so you can, you know, it changes hands. The new person can start depreciating it from new. And that means you can start this whole process over. Now, bonus depreciation was introduced, like I said, the 100% bonus, which allowed people to take this huge amount of deductions in the first year. Now, this year, 2023, at the time of this recording, it's gone down and it was in the plan to start phasing out, as you alluded to. This year, it's 80% bonus, which means you can only take 80% of those accelerated deductions in the first year. And then the remaining 20% will still be spread over that 5 and 15 year schedule. Another really important thing to note, I think you also asked earlier about, you know, what about someone who owned, you know, was an accidental investor and maybe owned a property or two or whatever. I know, like, Ryan had, like, you know, a condo and this and that. Like, what? You know, I never did cost segregation. I never knew about this.
Good memory.
You can go back. You can go back. And yeah, I have this weird memory. I like,
that's good memory. That's like 2017 stuff. That's great.
Right. Yeah. The, you know, thank God it's a blessing. It's a gift, gift and a curse, you know, exactly. Things you don't want to remember. Sometimes you remember too, but you can go back and without actually even having to amend your tax returns, you can take those deductions, you can do a cost segregation now and basically catch up whatever depreciation you missed that you could have taken in previous years. And this is really important to note when it comes to the bonus depreciation. If you didn't do a cost segregation study and you bought a property between 2018 and 2022, you can still claim 100% bonus depreciation, even if you file taxes for that property and do the costing in 2023 or 24.
Huge.
Because it goes after when it was purchased.
That's huge. Even if you, and this is something that Toby Mathis brought up, even if you sold it, so if you bought a property in 2018, you sold it last year and you're like, God, I never did that cost seg, you can actually, as long as you still have access to the property, is that true that you can still run the cost seg retroactively?
As long as you didn't yet file taxes. Yeah.
Got it.
And right. Meaning it has to be in the same year that you sold the property, like right now, this year, 2023, you sold the property earlier this year. Right. And you can still do the cost seg for 2023 taxes.
If you can get into it, right?
Well, obviously, yeah.
Right. And I want to pull on that thread because a wise man once told me that it always makes sense to cost segregate. So why would somebody who sold property and realized a gain want to go back and do cost seg? What's the benefits to that?
So it probably wasn't a Weiss man that told you that because I wouldn't say that.
Oh, a Weiss man. Oh, I like it. Good dad.
But there's what's Weiss advice? You know, that's what it's right. All about.
Podcast. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
There are many times and occasions where you wouldn't want to get a cost segregation study done. And the main reason is if you can't benefit from those deductions. And I alluded to earlier that if you're not a real estate professional, so there's a special rule in the tax code that says that, well, first let's back up a step. When you have a rental property, that income from that rental property is treated as what's called passive income. Now, it may not be passive whatsoever, but the IRS treats it as such, and it's taxed differently than your active or your W-2 or 1099 or other type of portfolio income. That being said, depreciation and cost segregation, again, I'm using them interchangeably because it's just like, it's an accelerated depreciation, that can only be used to offset your passive income, meaning your rental income from any properties that you have. So if you have multiple properties, all the income is lumped together in one bucket and all the depreciation is lumped together. And so you can use the cost seg for, you know, depreciation from one property to offset income from all your properties. However, if you are a real estate professional, you can actually use those deductions not only offset your passive income, but also to offset your active or your W-2 or your spouse's W-2 income. So the main reason why I would say it's not beneficial to get a conservation study done is if you, you know, don't have that real estate professional status and don't have a lot of passive income or passive gains from the sale of real estate, you're just going to create all these passive losses, they're called. And sure, you can use them next year. They'll carry forward. You can use them in the future, but you're not really going to have much benefit in the current year. That's the first and foremost reason not to get it done.
Good points.
Let's talk about the real estate professional status real quick, because this is a topic we talk about a lot. We talked about it with Toby Mathis. We're planning on doing episodes that are just dedicated to this, but it is one of the most powerful strategies for reducing your tax liability under the sun. So I think anytime we have a chance to talk about it, let's dive into it. Let's spend the next 3 to 4 minutes just sort of outlining how this works and how you can take advantage of this, or maybe your spouse can take advantage of it.
Yeah. So the IRS says, and I always like to kind of preface this with one of my favorite paraphrased quotes from George Orwell's Animal Farm, right? It says, like, all animals are created equal, but some are more equal than others, right? So, so too, when it comes to taxpayers, right? Some, they're all equal, right? But some are more equal, meaning having this real estate professional status, and I'll define exactly what the IRS's guidelines are, like I said, allows you to kind of bypass this rule of only using depreciation to offset your passive income. You don't have that limitation. You can use that to offset all your income. So if you're a real estate broker, right, and you have a lot of income, you need to have some rental properties also. And so the rules are essentially you cannot have a full-time W-2 job and also claim real estate professional status.
Well, it means, I will jump in and say airline pilots are one of the only high-paid W-2 professions that can actually pull this off, because it's based on block hours flown. The highest number of block hours that we can fly in a year is 1,000 hours. So okay. I'll just jump in there. Yeah. But yes, please continue.
No. So it's really important. Generally speaking, it's very hard to do. However, you're absolutely right. There are certain there are exceptions where you may be able, but the key to this is two things. Number one, the IRS's rules say that you have to spend more than 50% of your 50% of your time in the real estate trader business, and that includes managing, operating, acquiring, constructing, renovating, et cetera, anything dealing with actually your own rental properties. And the second thing, which is really important, the most important part, is you actually have to log those hours. Okay, and it's a minimum of 750 hours a year. But if you're saying the maximum you can have is 1,000 hours, so you're going to need to show 1,001 hours at least of a year of the real estate trader business that you are documenting, tracking those hours in those activities that qualify for that, what's called material participation in the real estate. So it is, you're right, it is possible with most W-2s where you're working a 40-hour week, which I'd say the majority of people with W-2s, obviously not pilots, but others, maybe there are some flight attendants listening to this podcast also, right?
That's true. Yep.
If they're working more than 40 hours a week, it's essentially impossible. If your spouse is a real estate professional, then you automatically get it as well, which means that's a great option for someone who's a high income earner and their spouse is a real estate professional, owning rental properties, investing in real estate, can get you this, like you said, one of the most powerful tools in the tax code to essentially reduce your tax liability to zero if done right.
I love it. So just to clarify, if your spouse is able to qualify as a real estate professional, 750 hours logs the time, and it needs to be contemporaneous and reasonable. So if you said you met with your property manager for 6 hours, that's probably not reasonable.
Right.
But log the time, at least 750 hours, and also more than 50% of any time spent in any other trade or money-making activity. And also, we cannot combine hours, just to clarify that. If I did 250 hours and my spouse did 500, that would not qualify. One person has to log the entire 750. Now, once you accomplish this, this means that all of your passive income becomes active income, right? Because now real estate is considered your materially participating in real estate. So all those depreciation benefits are considered active, right?
Right, exactly. And so you were able to use those losses to offset your active income. I think it's a good point to kind of mention a couple exceptions to this rule, right? Besides for the real estate professional status. One is, and this is the most common one that most accountants get, and even the ones that kind of have a pushback when it comes to cost segregation, they'll know this rule that there is, if your adjusted gross income is under $100,000, then you're able to claim $25,000 of that passive losses, those depreciation deductions, to offset your active income. So that's one case where if you're making under $100,000, you can take $25,000 deduction, but that's, it's capped at $25,000 and actually phases out up to $150,000 of adjusted gross income. So if you're making $150,000 and above, you, this rule does not apply to you whatsoever. But if you're making between $100,000 or $150,000, then it's between $25,000 and $0 of that deduction. That's one of the most common exceptions to this rule of the passive activity losses and using them against your active income. The second and probably the most relevant, sorry, you want to go ahead?
No, go ahead.
I'd say probably the second and probably the most relevant for people who are maybe airline pilots or people who are working W-2 jobs and like can't fathom also becoming a real estate professional. Because I mean, think about it, even spending an extra 1,000 hours a year is a lot. That's a lot of time, right? Yep. And so you're going to need, you know, if you're self-managing your properties, but there is another exception to this rule that they call the short-term rental loophole. Now, it's not really a loophole because it's literally directly in the tax code and the passive activity rules, section 469, but it is, it's not, the way that it's written wasn't necessarily intended for what we know today as Airbnbs and short-term rentals, where a lot of people are owning them and self-managing them, renting them out, even if you, you know, access them remotely. Like it used to be if you were like running a hotel or you had like a little bed and breakfast in your house and you were like helping people and do that. That's kind of what it was meant to be. But it still works. And so this, if you materially participate, and it's different rules for from the real estate professional status, you're able to then also that income becomes active, you're able to use the losses or deductions from cost segregation on that short-term rental to then offset your active income or your W-2 income as well.
So I want to highlight this. This is super important. So if you're someone who's like, man, I wish I could get real estate professional status, but you know, my spouse works full-time, there's just no way. Listen to this, because this is one of the most powerful strategies where you can use a cost segregation, some bonus depreciation to offset your W-2 income. And it is by going out, buying a property and converting it immediately to a short-term rental and self-managing, right?
Correct. That's the most important part. A lot of people think, oh yeah, I'll have a property manager. Right. No, it's not going to work that way.
Yeah. But keep in mind, you only have to do that for the first tax year that you own the property, right?
Correct. That's a really good point. You know, because the material participation is looked at on a year by year basis. And so if you do the cost segregation in the first year and you also, or whatever year it is, and you also materially participate in that first year, you can take those deductions, claim that, and then the next year you don't have to. You can hand it over to a property manager because the deduction is the losses have already been taken.
Right. And you can hand it over to a property manager. And if you wanted to, you may love running it as an Airbnb, you might be getting great cash flow, but you could technically in the second year of ownership just convert it to a long-term rental with a property manager, right?
That's correct as well. Yeah.
Amazing.
So I want to jump back to the basics here. I'll make this really, really applicable to a pilot who's listening to this, who's got 5 rental properties, never done cost seg, and that person is debating, do I do this or not? And so how would you walk that person through deciding to do this study or not?
The first thing is have a conversation with your accountant, okay? Like we said, if they tell you, you know, this is a red flag or it's going to raise an audit, it may be worthwhile to seek out a real estate focused CPA who can, you know, make sure that you are doing the right thing and trying to actually strategize with you, not just filing out forms and really understanding.
And by the way, Tate and I have a Rolodex of those people. So if you don't have one, reach out to us. We have tons of recommendations. So.
Awesome. Awesome. Really important to, you know, person to have on your team. And the second thing I would say is, you know, reach out to someone like myself where you can get a free upfront analysis. You can take a look at the properties you own or properties you're looking to buy and see, hey, does this actually make sense to do a cost segregation study? Am I actually going to save money? Is it going to be worthwhile? And I think for most people, it's a no-brainer, meaning either the numbers make sense and it's like, yeah, okay, I'm going to spend $3,000 and save 50 or 100 or a million, right? Yeah. It's pretty much a no-brainer. So that's the process I would take. And then from there, it's pretty smooth sailing.
Right. What about, you know, can I run a cost segregation study on my house? Or what about a, and then I, these are big questions, condos and townhomes. So let's attack all of those.
Yeah. First, your house, you cannot claim depreciation on your primary residence. That's first and foremost. It's only for a rental or business property. There are certain exceptions, you know, people, what if I have a duplex? This is really, really great, you know, common questions that come off of this question. I have a duplex, I'm house hacking, right? I have a duplex, I live in one unit, rent out the other. In that case, you can only depreciate 50% or whatever prorated amount of the rental space there is based on your purchase price. You just basically prorate that amount. Condos, townhomes, you can certainly do a cost segregation, obviously, if it's a rental property. The only differences, really differences that come up between a regular, you know, property, and that is the land value or the land improvements as well. And that's going to be in the documentation. If you actually have ownership or you don't have ownership, sometimes the condo association owns the land. And so you won't have any money being allocated to land value, which means your whole purchase price is going to go towards the depreciation. But that also means you won't have any of those land improvements, which are accelerated depreciation. And so it's just, it's nuanced. You have to look at your specific scenario.
Interesting. Is there a good example of you know, what types of, you know, if you own a rental property in a building that was built in the 80s versus one that's brand new, is there any sort of rules of thumb around that? Or is it totally nuanced and just contact you for a consultation?
It is very nuanced because it's going to have to do with, you know, the size of the property, square footage, right? The amount of land improvements you're talking about. If it's a condo in a building, you know, there's going to be much less depreciation there because, again, you're dealing right. with the structure. The one difference that has to do with the when the property was built, if you're dealing with like literally brand new construction, which is very common, you'll buy a property like straight from the builder and from the contractor and put it in service. When it's new construction, there's always going to be more relative value placed in the structural components. Okay, it's always going to cost more, right? Brand new, it's costing more. But as time goes on, the value of the building actually wears down or lessens its value from a depreciation perspective because it's been depreciated, so to speak. And so therefore, there's going to be less relative value in the structure.
One thing I learned about cost seg that in bonus depreciation that I didn't realize when I started buying self storage, adding on to it, or building self storage from the ground up is you actually can get additional, you know, you get the first onslaught of depreciation in the first year that you buy the assets. But if you expand them or put capital improvements into the property, you can actually tell your CPA what you've done and you can actually bonus and cost seg that stuff. Can you kind of speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, anytime you buy a property, we like to do the cost seg on what's called the acquisition, right? The purchase. So kind of documenting what the property is when it was purchased. And so you're able to take that purchase price, break it down to its components. Anytime, and so that doesn't change if the property goes up in value. Let's say, you know, you buy it and then it gets appraised for twice the value. That does not change the depreciation, unfortunately. Right. The only thing that is going to change that tax basis, as it's called, is if you add capital improvements, you add money into the property. In your case, right, you build more facilities on the land, right? So any money that's spent, you can now depreciate those costs as well. And it can be cost segregated for any improvements that's put in.
And I think
let's apply that.
What's that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, let's apply that to an example of someone who, let's say, owns a fourplex. So tenant moves out and they put $60,000 into, you know, unit number 4 to renovate it to a super nice standard with quartz countertops and new appliances mm-hmm. and flooring and lighting and all sorts of stuff. Would that make sense? Because you'd have to run a new cost segregation study at that point, right?
So we do what's called like an updated or renovation study. And it's really important that the cost segregation is done before any renovations are completed. Mm-hmm. Because if not, then you're not able to double dip. You're not able to claim, right, the accelerated depreciation deductions on the things that are already gone from the prior. Right. You're not able to take a deduction, a write-off of something that doesn't exist anymore. So it's important to get it done, like I said, before any renovations are done. And then once the money is spent on renovations, you can then go ahead and do an updated or renovation study, which is, you know, a fraction of the cost of what a full cost segregation study would be, and then just capitalize those improvements.
That's such a good tip.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, it really like, because it was kind of neat. Like we take the deal that you're in Mini West. We mm-hmm. Bought the property. Madison Specs did a you know, Yona's team did a cost segregation. You guys estimated, I think, 1.7. I think you came back at like 2.1 of actual depreciation on the acquisition. And then we added on 240 units, spent about $1.6 million or so. And then so in that third year, when we delivered those units into service, the investors got more depreciation from that. So then we had a K-1 that gave them more write-offs kind of midstream as they were getting cash flow. Mm-hmm. They got more depreciation to continue to offset their passive income. And I think it's just, it was a nice surprise to me in a good way. I didn't really know that in 2018 going into the deal, but I was like, oh, that's right. That makes sense. You know, we put more units on the property, you get to actually depreciate it. So something kind of to note if you're an operator or a fourplex guy, keep track of everything that you're spending on capital improvements and then make sure your CPA is aware that you've dumped more money into the property. Let's talk about ground up development. You know, we have a ground up development fund and we build new self storages in there, and people ask if there's depreciation, and I say yes, but I don't know when it's going to happen. Can it kind of unpack that a little bit, right? We're going to have depreciation eventually because we plan to buy and operate these properties, but why is it getting a little less predictable in that instance?
Because depreciation as a deduction can only be claimed on a rental property once it's considered placed in service. Okay, that's the language of the IRS. So you can only claim the depreciation or start the cost segregation once the property is in completion. Now, if it's coming in stages, you may be able to do it in stages, but essentially ground up development, you can take all those costs and segregate them and break them down to the faster categories only once the project's been completed.
That's great. Right. Now let's talk about this lower leverage environment that we're in. You know, one thing that was quite frankly a little bit of a disappointment or a surprise to us this year was one of our funds that set out to buy self-storage took on less leverage because the interest rates are higher. So that's requiring more equity to go into the deal. And then we obviously have more investors to share that depreciation with. So have you run into this with other clients? Kind of a disappointing number this year for depreciation.
It is, because the depreciation is going to be based on the purchase price, whether you have financing or not. So, you know, in a simple example, let's say, just keep it simple, you have $1 million property investment and you have 10 investors and everyone owns an equal share and they come in with all cash and it's $100,000, right, each, and you're able to get 25% depreciation. And let's just keep it simple with bonus depreciation taken the first year. That means that each one of you is going to get $25,000 because 25% of the million is 250, divide that by 10, each one's going to get 25,000, meaning you're going to get 25% of your invested capital as a first year depreciation deduction. Now let's use that same scenario where you have 10 investors but instead of $1 million property, you're using financing, right? And so you're using a 75% leverage, let's say. And so you're able to get a $5 million property for that same $1 million of invested capital from those 10 investors who are putting $100,000 each. Now, when you're getting that $5 million back, what is that? Or $4 million, sorry, probably more likely, right? $4 million. Mm-hmm. You're able to get 25% of that, which equals $1 million, meaning you're getting 100% of your invested capital back as a depreciation deduction in the first year, because the financing adds to the purchase price as the depreciable deduction. So the difference between, you know, the equity and the loan value is going to, you know, equally distribute the effect of the how much depreciation you're going to get.
Yeah, that was a unpleasant surprise for me this year, because obviously interest rates are higher. So the bank is going to look at your leverage and say, hey, we have to throttle back the amount of leverage you're going to take because your debt service coverage ratio isn't going to be able to cover that higher interest rate loan. So like back in the glory days of 2021 and prior, when the Fed funds rate was zero and interest rates were 3%, we could take a nice high leverage and really be efficient with the depreciation allocation that goes out. And this year, when we were leveraging less, you know, we're now like 55-60% leverage on our assets, which is great for risk, but not that favorable for depreciation. So something to think about as an investor as you go on, and add on to the fact that we also have a declining bonus depreciation amount.
Right.
Is this your 80% or is it 60% now?
Yeah, 80.
80. Okay.
2023 is 80. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully we can get bonus depreciation back. Any insights from Congress on that? Are you storming the Capitol here and demanding more bonus?
There are a lot of lobbyists, believe it or not, that are interested in bringing back 100% bonus depreciation. Actually, in a bill that was passed in the House already that includes the restoration of 100% bonus, it still obviously needs to go through the Senate and then be signed off by the president. So it may take a change of administration for something like that to happen, but the fact that it's being talked about, the fact that it's, you know, in a bill means that there are enough people making noise about it that they care.
That's incredible. So it's really important for investors to understand their appetite for depreciation, right? Because if you don't have any appetite for it, then it doesn't make sense to pile on and do a bunch of depreciation.
Right.
If you have an appetite for it, so let's say you actually can claim the real estate professional status. You make the 750 hours either by yourself or with your spouse. Well, then you have this appetite, and it's important to note that you can collect, you know, depreciation benefits both from your own personal property, but also through investing in syndications. So if you invest in Ryan's syndication or one of our deals, you know, you are going to get, you know, a wide range from deal to deal. It might be anywhere from 0 to 100%. We had a mobile home park deal last year that the K-1 came in. We had a 96.8%. depreciation benefit on that K-1. So if someone invested $100,000, they would be getting a $96,800 phantom loss, even though that project is cash flowing over 10%. And if you are a real estate professional, that means you could take that $96,800 and write it directly off your W-2. However, if you're not the real estate professional, it basically does nothing. It just sits there and it can offset the other passive income. And so if you can't get the real estate professional status, it's very important to build that appetite, right? Buy more syndication deals, buy more property so that you have more passive income, because it's the easiest kind of income to offset. So I don't know. I just wanted to throw that out there and get your thoughts on that.
No, I agree. Absolutely. That's a very good point.
Excellent.
Well, Yona, what's one thing that you've never, what is the biggest thing you've learned in the last 6 months that you haven't shared with anybody yet?
Well, you know, I talk all the time on social media, I don't know.
I know you do.
What I haven't shared. Kind of hard to think about what I haven't shared.
And by the way, if you want to connect with Yona on LinkedIn, he is amazing content. So
incredible.
He is an incredible connector. The Weiss Advice podcast, excellent podcast. Download it. We'll put the link in the show notes. We want to promote Yona as much as we can.
Twitter as well.
Twitter. Yeah. So anyway, we'll have a whole link to all your stuff, and you can tell us how to get in touch with us here in just a minute. But I'm stalling here to give you the thing that you
give me the time to think about what one thing is. Exactly. Yeah. I would say one thing, maybe I have shared it, but one thing that really has stood out to me recently is, and I'm sure your listeners may have heard this, you guys talk about this before, but the book called Who Not How, which is essentially a mindset shift in understanding how to accomplish more in life and reach your goals at a much faster pace by changing how you think about getting to those goals, and not how I can do that, and which is just taking your own personal energy, but who can help me do that, and just enlisting the help from other people. And that has been something that's literally been a night and day shift in my own personal life and business the past year. But something I haven't really talked about much on social media, the power of that.
It's a great book.
It is.
Yeah, I read that over the winter, and it's kind of like, as pilots, like, we want to know how to do everything.
Right.
Right. We want to know how to fly the plane. We want to know how to call the ramp. All the things that go into flying. Right. But you know, we have to rely on the who's to carry out our hows. And I think that's super important. And, you know, Yona's a great example, like, who, not how. I don't know anything about cost segregation, but Yona knows how. And even Yona actually doesn't go out and physically do the inspections and cost segs himself. He knows he has his who's to carry out his hows, right? And so I think the whole point of this podcast is to assemble your army of who's, you know, who can help me carry out the house. And that's the whole point of bringing this podcast together and all these experts together, because me and Tate are not the experts. We have a lot of who's to carry out our house, right? And And you may be the who that's carrying out somebody else's hell. Anyway, not to sound like Dr. Seuss here, but that basically is the book, right? So check it out. Who is the author of that? Is it Ben Hardy? Is that a Ben Hardy book?
Ben Hardy and Dan Sullivan, based on Dan Sullivan. Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent book. Put that in the show notes as well. But Yonah, really thanks for coming on, and we appreciate you having us share your wisdom with us. How can listeners get in touch with you?
As you mentioned, you can definitely find me in all the socials on the LinkedIn and the new X platform out there.
That's right. Twitter is rebranded.
The platform
X.
Formerly known as Twitter, right? Yeah. and Instagram, whatever it is, you can also go to yonahweiss.com. But again, if you do find me on any of the socials, I always love it when someone shoots me a little note. Don't just hit that follow button. Shoot me a little note. Passive Income Pilots podcast. I loved it. Shoot me a little note and I'll know it came from there.
Well, thanks so much, Yonah.
Well, I know we've sent at least one pilot to you for a cost seg so far. If somebody wants to get a cost segregation study done, how do they reach out?
Same way. They're probably the best way. You can also just find our website, Madison Specs. That's our company. Or just reach out directly.
Madison Specs also does a lot of title work, escrow. They do a whole suite of things. So if you're looking in the real estate game, they're a really good point of contact for that. So
amazing. Yonah, thank you so much for coming on. We'll see you later.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.